Welcome, friends of the Libra Solutions Network. This is Gabriel, and I am honored to be joined by Liam Sturgis of White Rose Intelligence. I put my work on LibraSolutions.network, and you can check out Liam's work at WhiteRoseIntelligence.com. Now, I have a really exciting discussion for you today, because many people are concerned about digital IDs, and it's very easy for people to get enamored by how it's being presented to us, where people are warning us about the privacy risks, the ways the access can be restricted for all areas of life. But we're not really seeing how it's being presented to the public or people who are, let's say, on side on this issue. So I came across this PeerTube instance, Canadian Civil. Oddly enough, they're unique for running Google Analytics on a PeerTube instance. I had never seen that before. And their video is titled, Canada Fell Behind on Digital ID. And the YouTube channel actually has it slightly different. It says Canadian passports are insecure and slow, and that came out a little bit earlier, but that is the video we're going to be responding to. Liam, is there any just quick thoughts you want to share before we dive right in?
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much, Gabe, for having me. I always love having discussions like this, whether we're talking about, you know, arts, music, fun stuff like that, or we're going to talk about how crazy and slow and problematic the government can be and what the solutions look like. Regardless of what we're talking about, I really enjoy hanging out with you. So thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And I want to say right off the bat, those two titles are very different, and they're very different subject matter if you think about it. And it is interesting that the video we're going to watch does cover both.
Yeah. And so just to reiterate, the reason why I think this is worth discussing is because I am opposed to digital IDs being used as a mechanism to gate access to various acts of life, just like we saw with the vaccine passports, especially here in Canada during the COVID crisis. And so that's the place where I'm coming from. And we'll start the video.
I have 2 expired passports from different countries. I am going to apply for both of these at the same time. And have a... So I'm gonna have this passport race between New Zealand and Canada to see which one is better at providing this basic government service that most people in a country will need at some point during their life. Oh my God, it's Page for a Future. I'm still waiting on one of the passports. The big issue, the first and most obvious issue, hits you on form PPTC 5+. That's for government.
So he says the first issue that hits you is the form. The first issue that should hit you is remembering that the government of Canada had a serious backlog in processing, well, really in every government agency. But in particular, I don't know if people remember this, but the passport offices were the ones most heavily hit. And then, of course, when did this video come out, Gabe?
February of 2022.
Yeah, so I believe it was around then that that they were having serious backlog issues. So I think that would apply whether you're applying in person or online, as we're going to watch him go through. So I think that's just important context, you know, as a factor in why the Canadian one might have been taking so long. But maybe he'll tell us, you know, other ways in which it was flawed.
Trying to verify that you are a unique person. There are many Robert Smiths in Canada. It may even be a Robert Smith born on the same day in the same city, but all of that and the mother's last name. And I mean, the mother's last name really dates the system. Traditionally, this would be a different name to yours, and unknown fathers are more common than unknown mothers. You rode away one day, never came home. Your first name, your last name, your birth date, your place of birth, and your mother's name are a very long, unique identifier for you. And with that information, government workers can pretty much pinpoint anyone, and that would be fine if it was the 1950s still. However, it's not, and repeating this information again and again to match me to a database that the government has wastes tons of time and is really insecure. If only there was a convenient, universal identifier for you and the government to communicate. Oh wait, there is, but it's shit. It's called a SIM number. Now, with just this one number, we can let the government know who we are. And that would be fine if it was the 1980s. However, it's not. And now anyone can use a short string of numbers and our name to basically ruin our lives. You see, even though legally you shouldn't, many organizations still ask you for your social insurance number because that is the standard universal identifier for a person here. What else are they going to use? But they constantly ruin people's lives. I mean, here is a series of numbers. By random chance alone, one of these numbers probably belongs to a Canadian citizen.
Going to pause it there because I think that's an important point and set of points fundamentally. When with how things are now, they're asking for the same set of pieces of information over and over. And what I find fascinating about that is it illustrates a problem that I've been trying to communicate to people in general, which is if somebody's information is in a data breach somewhere, for instance, some big site gets hacked and then email addresses and other pieces of information are put out there, even though that those pieces of information themselves may not be particularly worrisome, it's when you combine innocuous data points across different data sets, you can really start to uniquely identify people and do other things. So that is not only a serious concern, but I also think it's one that is not understood enough. And what's fascinating is he points out that SIN numbers in Canada are a finite digit set that really, I have a feeling that has an expiry date at some point anyways. And there are ways to solve that problem. You can't just make them longer. There are different ways of serializing these numbers to add security features. For instance, credit cards will have various self-checking mechanisms. That's why they know immediately when you enter a wrong one. And there are many different ways around that. The challenge, though, is if you're going to switch away from it, what are you going to switch to? And that seems to be the root of this discussion.
Well, and also, I'm just not sure if his premise is also that organizations, even though they shouldn't, do ask for that because it is the identifier. But I'm struggling to think of any organization I've ever given it to other than the government or right. or my employer for tax purposes. So I'm wondering what else might cause that to come up as something you might need to give an organization apart from those two.
Well, what I'm imagining is being described here is when you go to the doctors, you know, the doctor is not a government doctor, you know, it's through OHIP or the other system, but you see a lot of this when you're signing up to a new institution. I don't know if you need it for colleges and universities, but those kinds of institutions that are heavily regulated here in Canada, I assume are where this overlaps a lot with.
I think you're right. That answers my question. I think you're right.
It's so insecure and should never have been used for anything except internal record keeping. Now, if you don't like the idea of being a number, you already are a number, but just in a less convenient form.
And so there we have quote number one that I wrote down.
Ah.
You already are a number, but just in a less convenient form. And this has just a tone to it and sort of an air around it that sort of accepts a premise of, well, we're already in a, you know, kind of on its own scary sounding situation. So now let's just make it a more efficient, scary situation. And of course, we don't have to talk about, you know, the very nuanced problems that can be solved here in a way that requires it to be a scary situation. Like there's very practical things we can discuss. I just thought that was a very dystopian way for him to put it, combined with the tattoo of a barcode.
That was a little explicit, yeah.
It's like he tried to, and not offensive, I don't feel offended by that or anything, and I'm not saying anyone should. I'm just saying, whoa, let's stop there and discuss the premise before we keep going, I guess. So I just thought I'd bring that up.
Well, I think one of the things that will overlap with that point is if the bureaucracy is so big that you are just a number to them, maybe that's a problem. Maybe we do need governments that understand our needs and who we are as individuals better, rather than simply just accepting the bureaucratic, this is a faraway institution that has no connection to us. I feel like that's fundamentally the root of what many different aspects of this problem.
The modern circa 2007 standard for this. Well, the first thing that you notice about the passport renewal process in New Zealand was the fact that you logged into it using this thing called RealMe. So you know how you can log in with Google, Apple, or Facebook? Well, in New Zealand, you can log in with the government login called RealMe. You create a username, you prove that you are who you say you are, and that you live where you say you live, one time, and then you use that service to log in and fill out forms across the entire government, and not just national government things like a passport. You can literally book a government building using the same system, and I did. Now, obviously, this saves the government departments money every year. You aren't building the same system again and again for every single government department. That benefit, though, isn't just for one level of government. That system is open to any valid organization. So the
And that, to me, is fundamentally the rub. The you know, streamlining of logins and different aspects of government that already exist is a defensible point. And that's kind of the mot to the, you know, the Bailey to the mot they're trying to establish, which is, oh, but this can be used everywhere else, all these other institutions. And this is where the gating becomes, and honestly, even surveillance, depending on how far you want to take this, becomes a serious problem. Because if you are using the same account for everything and it becomes your life, are there punishments that can be metered out based off that system? Are there ways that can be restricted? And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about today before I was, you know, preparing for this was, fundamentally, if your entire life is attached to a single account, it is way more important that every detail of security matters for that account rather than you have a random account for some online game you never touch. And who cares if it gets hacked, you know, a couple of years, you know, that's one thing, as long as you don't have any sensitive information. But if this account is someone's entire life and the ability to do everything, the bar for it to be properly secured is way higher than just, oh, it's convenient, it's easy to use, and institutions like it.
Yeah, and by the way, this went really fast from just one login for service to, if you just scroll back a couple of frames, Gabe, if you don't mind, you're going to see a bunch of, yeah, like here, if you hit play. Yeah, there. You see really quick, that's the legal system, that's the banks, that's, I guess, your licensing maybe is what that means, your ability maybe to vote. And academia. Some of those are government. Some of them, well, they're all regulated by government, right? I guess. There's some question as to whether that makes sense. The point is, this is far more than just logging in to renew your passport really fast. And we're going to hear in a minute, he's going to talk about libraries. He's going to talk about your small local library in whatever, you know, rural place in New Zealand he mentions. So you talk about gating and the risk of having this all in one spot. Look at all of the things that, if whether by security, you know, flaw, security breach, or by, you know, dystopian wrongthink, look at all the things you could be shut out of.
And this is something, what I think the sleight of hand that is being played with this video, where they make it seem like they're just talking about a more efficient government login, but now we're talking about expanding the scope of this system to many different areas of life. And that's fundamentally where the problem of digital ID comes from. I don't think anyone fundamentally objects to, oh, the CRA login we have here in Canada will be used with other government, you know, institutions, because yes, it's the same institution. Nobody probably cares. But when it comes to this drive to expand it out there, really explains why there is such a big push for digital ID in general.
Valid organization. So the smallest library of the smallest city in some shithole in New Zealand,
Dunedin, like every other South Island town, it's a hole,
can leverage the login system of the national government of a country to make sure that you can actually take out a copy of how to talk to your cat about gun safety.
Now, this is another really strange choice he made. Why is that book the example he gave for a book you might take out at the library that for some reason the government should know you took out?
Right. And I find that I've seen a couple of their videos, and that tone definitely reflects a lot. Like, I believe there's even an element that they may be trying to pre-bunk, which is what they call, you know, addressing information in a way that makes the desired narrative more accepted, rather than any questions or criticisms or concerns people might have about the way these systems are building out, what their ultimate purpose is, and how they can impact people in real time. And I think you're right about that particular book, because as far as I'm aware, library books are not perfectly anonymous. But at the same time, just because the information is out there doesn't necessarily mean we need to pass it around all the time. I believe the answer to what we're talking about here, as far as this whole video is concerned, is we probably need to be harsher on what our government is doing with data, period, whether or not it's with a digital ID or just part of their day-to-day operations.
Yeah, just on the library point, I have a library card. And it's hooked into the, I guess you could say, because it's a district run library, it's hooked into the district government, you know, district where I live. Okay. But so far as I know, that data, you know, if I check out a book on this day at this time, that data exists and can later be accessed, of course, by anybody who is given access to it, you know, including the government or bad actors. But right now, I'm not under the impression that I've been informed or given consent or anything that for that data.
Exactly. You
know, the book I got in 2020 that I haven't returned. True story. that's not being shared with any level of government above. Like, there's no reason to think the district is even looking at it, even though they have direct ownership of it. And so that's the key difference here. It's not as if it's perfectly anonymous right now. Like, we're talking about fundamental changes in how we think about our role in or our relationship with the government. Do you know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Oh, just one more thing. Sorry. It is important to note, I think, you know, in Canada and New Zealand, we don't have the same gun. Like, guns have a very specific role in society, and it's generally completely absent, at least in terms of like how we would interact day to day with people. But in New Zealand in particular, again, the reason that book is so interesting to me, because you have this really recent, I think it was the Christchurch shooting that was in New Zealand, right? Not Australia. Which resulted in, you know, the mass, like, I don't really know what the law was like before that, but I do know that after that, that was a turning point where now, like, this sort of extreme anti-gun aspect of society is palpable. And it is notable, again, as in relation to why they picked that book. It's just, it tickles my brain in a way that makes me uncomfortable.
Well, push on.
So much time as well. You never write out your fucking mother's name again, which is especially great for the woke members of our audience, because who says that a woman can't walk out on her family? You never have to send another copy of your ID or print a utility bill or fill in your place of birth again. And remember,
another fair point I think is worth discussing in this context is one of the convenience gains of this kind of a system is, oh, you don't have to send your documents to different companies for KYC. So if you need to sign up to, you know, a crowdfunding site or donations or whatever online business you want to start, generally it starts with you sending them a selfie and a picture of your photo ID. Fundamentally, this is a problem. There have been instances of people's photo ID and identification being basically unsecured and up for grabs when some of these systems aren't run properly. So it is worth mentioning that there is a serious concern here. I think there's two sides of this, though. Do we really need KYC for every single piece of economic activity online? Especially when, let's be honest, especially here as Canadians, you know, if you're using your regular bank, they know about it. It's not like you're getting regular money outside the system. Like, yes, there's cryptocurrency, but most cryptocurrency isn't KYC'd anyway. So it's a completely non-starter. And to me, this is when it comes to this system, it feels like part of a building block of something bigger rather than necessarily just the logins, which is what is really being focused on here.
That extends to everything from banks and universities to passport renewals like I did. When you use it on a service, you can decide what you want to share. Just your name or your birthday, your government verified address. You're basically saying to the government, okay, I give you permission. Let these guys know where I live. Let them know what my name is. And all of this is secure, password protected for the modern era and backed by two-factor authentication. Doing it once the right way means that every government service that uses it also gets those benefits. None of those flimsy and deeply flawed, what was your first pet's name questions, which are the online security equivalent of the Riven method. Enjoy your new child. Also, no uncertain answers to questions. I mean, was my childhood best friend really Scott? Nathan was the first, so is that what I would have written? But then, I mean, Scott's really come back into the fold.
So, next in line. First, I have no idea what that reference to some sex method is. Maybe I'm a prude. I don't know what he was talking about. I do, however, relate hard to that exact example he gave of the childhood best friend.
Right.
Like, the exact same thought process. It's not like, my problem is I had a bunch of good friends, you know, and so that was one of my big takeaways as I was watching this, is there are peppered in here immensely relatable things. You know, I agree with the basis of what this video is saying, which is we've got these problems that are ubiquitous for everyone using them. So I just thought I'd mention that.
Well, this is a good time to point out that authentication is not the same thing as identification, although they are being tied together in this particular instance. When it talks about asking these security questions, which, yes, I agree, security card questions are garbage. There are those examples of how somebody asks somebody, you know, a bunch of different information about them, and then ta-da, you've got their account. Many accounts are secured by basically that, because that was the standard for a certain period of time. And now we're learning that that wasn't a good idea. And truthfully, I think that kind of undermines the argument of doing some of this, is we have been learning as we're going on. And so there are risks to doing this too early. Doubling down on the authentication point, one of the things I'm really curious about right now is I think authentication is a much more interesting problem than somebody pushing this particular solution would really give it credit, because there are many different ways to potentially authenticate. For instance, this is a downright silly method, but I wouldn't recommend it, but it's an option where, for instance, if you went to your bank and you said, this is my Facebook profile when you signed up and you identified your profile. And so then they had a little Facebook bot that communicated with you. And so as long as you have access to your Facebook account, well, then you can still do log into your bank. Now, obviously, I don't trust Facebook. I'm not a fan of him. And that's, you know, not a particularly great method. But what I'm pointing out here is you have the option to meet people where you're at if you introduce flexibility. And then you can do multi-factor authentication. It's like, oh, they need your Facebook account. Oh, and also a password, you know, or some other pieces of information. That's what multi-authentication, in my mind, really should be. It's about using many different options that are more importantly selected by the user. Right now, it's too narrow. It's like either you have a password, either you have a cell phone, either you have an email, and then everything else is up the river. But it's like there are many different ways, especially now, to communicate. And we shouldn't limit authentication to just these pre-prescribed methods. I do think there does need to be more flexibility, because if, I hate to say it, if people are using Facebook, why not let them use it? Facebook at least is more secure than, you know, those particular questions, if nothing else, fundamentally. And I think one of the things they're doing here is tying these authentication problems to the question of, should you be able to easily identify yourself to everyone all the time online, which is really where I have a point of separation with their points.
Time, please.
Passwords are the minimum now. If you find out that someone has figured out your password, maybe they do a little bit of damage and then you can get it reset. But if you find out someone has figured out knowledge of your childhood, you can't change that. You were born there. That was your first.
It's worth pointing out you can't change biometrics either. So it is worth pointing out that collecting biometrics is a serious concern in general.
Pet's name. Research shows that many victims of identity theft are actually being targeted by members of their own family for this reason. So with a password, you just reset it, and it's something that you keep as your own secret. No one else knows that. A single sign-on is especially good because there are simply too many places to secure. Every bank account, every phone company, every health department or utility company. But now, across Canada, is a flimsy set of numbers like your passport number or your healthcare card number, and they unlock your identity to the world. And this is because the government hasn't stepped up and filled that void with a real authentication service for citizens.
I just want to circle back to, I'm way back at the, do we even want a society and a system that even accepts the premise that we all have a number assigned to us, no matter how secure or insecure it is. I'm not expecting you or everyone else to be there with me. I'm just saying I don't accept as a given that we're past that discussion being logical in the first place.
Well, and I'm going to sound like a bit of a broken record here, but it sounds like his argument boils down to authentication is hard. The private sector hasn't solved it. So let's let the government step in and solve the problem. And truthfully, as somebody who is in the tech space, I don't think gating authentication behind government for everything is a good idea. I mean, if governments want to enhance their own login systems and keep it within house, and then you have a convenient way of accessing multiple services, that's a defensible point, but not when you start saying, oh yes, and then it will run your entire life. Like, that's quite a crazy leap. And like you said, say, not everybody's going to agree with that. In fact, there will always be people who don't want that. And this video in particular doesn't discuss the option of what if you don't want this? What if somebody does want an analog option? Should we, how do we properly preserve people's ability to do this stuff, whether it's go to school, whether it's go to a doctor's appointment or, you know, get a passport without opting into all these crazy online services that in many ways are in working with private sector partners. It's not purely a government enterprise. And that's one of the more misleading things about this is he's casting it as like, oh, the government's doing this, but it's not always entirely government. I mean, it is as easy as it being served by AWS. How independent is this system really if it's still using mainstream cloud platforms? If the government doesn't have its own in-house IT, how sovereign is that really? And that's not a trivial point because the EU is starting to take this very seriously.
And just to be clear, the government isn't building anything. They are contracting the development of all of this. I can't think of a single thing off the top of my head in this context that would be built by the government itself. That's not its job. You know, it like for all of these things, in theory, we have robust, you know, contract protections and, you know, you hire this firm, you know, which is that very private sector he's lambasting for not bringing it. Like, it's just not true that it's not the private sector doing this. It's just a matter of who's paying them.
Yep.
I wanted to figure out how New Zealand got to this point, so I literally called them up. Hilariously, small country stuff. Is this the Prime Minister?
Yep.
I interviewed Tim Waldron, who is a manager at RealMe, and he answered lots of questions that I had. Thanks, mate.
Good on you. Good on you. Good on you. Good on you. Good on you, mate.
According to Tim, in the early 2000s, New Zealand was actually looking at Canada to see how to do online services for the government. Canada was seen as a leader in this space. At the time, New Zealand didn't even have Lord of the Rings to its name, let alone broadband internet. The New Zealand government created the 2000 e-government strategy. This strategy identified logins as a key project, and now with 5.7 million logins in a country of 5 million citizens, it is a ubiquitous standard. So how did New Zealand end up beating Canada to this basic building block of e-governance, a secure digital ID? Well, that plan did include creating a government login system. The first obvious big user was the New Zealand equivalent of the CRA, allowing them to ditch the insecure SIN number problem that New Zealand also had at the time. But critically, built into these early plans was a consultation and citizen involvement process, which was probably even more important than having the login system specified. That iterative process allowed it to evolve with the times and move away from being a tax department login as the internet grew and changed. They were just very focused on making it useful and good, treating citizens like customers. So to this day, they still bring in focus groups of citizens and ask them what they need and make the changes. And then they repeat that process, just constantly making sure that the thing that they're doing actually meets the need of New Zealand citizens. It was.
Can I just, I did a little research into RealMe. And nice. Closer to this article in the spinoff from December 2021, headline, What is RealMe and Why Do People Hate It So Much? And I was looking at it because I was trying to place it in the larger global digital ID ecosystem that we both have been looking at, you know, from different angles. And I was trying to see if it was hooked into what I suspected it was hooked into, which is the smart health card, you know, digital health passport infrastructure. And this article is basically about, well, first of all, RealMe is just bad in general, according to these folks expressing their concerns, but also it was used. It's the platform you would use to register for your, I believe they call it a New Zealand. They have their own COVID pass, basically. Mm. Which, by the way, this is a bit non sequitur, but on that COVID pass note, I did find a government statement on it. This is from a report. I quote, "The introduction of vaccine certificates has provided some validity to the concept that unvaccinated individuals should be managed differently to individuals who are vaccinated because of their public health risk." So just as another kind of, you know, red flag on the being barred out of certain aspects of society, I just thought that was potentially notable.
And the way I would summarize that very basically is if you give government the tools to do more things, your problems related to government expand. They can come up in different areas in different ways. And I think it's really important to consider, especially in the context of vaccine passports, that this is being presented as, oh, we did all these nice public consultations for a new login system, therefore we need a digital ID in all aspects of your life. And those two things are not, you know, in any ways directly related. They're making the leap so that you have this nice little like thing you can hand on to. It's like, oh, we should have better governments working more efficiently. That's great, right? But the challenge and what really kind of concerns me about this is you notice they don't do these public consultations about other policies. How many nations have had public consultations about their foreign aid to various wars overseas or various other policies over the last little bit? They didn't ask people what they thought of lockdowns. Let's be real, you know, fundamentally, when government wants something and at the expense of people, they'll do it anyways. So I believe these consultations are more of a way of collecting the early objections to these systems so that they can try to either dodge around them or simply find talking points to present them differently.
Yeah, and I just want to point out, I think, first of all, some of those things you said, those were decisions made decades ago. And they but on the other hand, I do think, in fact, these consultations exist, and they're not supposed to be easy to find out about. That's what I believe is most likely the case.
So weird hearing a government official saying customer-centric design so much. And you can see the impact of this even in the name. It started off as the government login service, which became iGov, which finally became RealMe in 2013. At first glance, you wouldn't even know that it was a government department. It looks like a private sector enterprise. The name changes reflect society. It becomes friendlier each time. This is through putting people in a room and asking them, hey, what do you want? And then just figuring out how to fucking do it. Good God, is it really as simple as making a plan that values citizens and then executing it? Yeah, it is. But here's the real surprise. There are places in Canada that are already doing this. So what Canada does have, and this is at the federal level, is a CRA login. But that is very minimal and can only be used for tax and business related things. Canada has GC key, but it doesn't let you log into the CRA or passport services, which are the most common interactions that Canadians are going to have with the federal government. And there is a more universal system.
Or if you're me, you're trying to log into the access to information system, which for some reason, so they have that that GCID they were just talking about. You don't need to log in. You can, at least until like this week, you could just, you know, put in your email. They send a verification email and then they go, great, you're this person. Okay. And then you fill in, of course, your private information. So it's not as if they're not, you know, collecting information about who you are. But, you know, this past week, I've no longer been receiving those verification emails, no matter which address I use. And so what are my options now? If I want to continue filing ATIP requests, I've at the moment, it looks like I've got to sign up for their GC key. Sometimes you just feel like you're being funneled, I guess is what I would say.
Yeah, I do think a lot of that has been what's going on. For instance, later he'll talk about the problems of the private sector partners, and those were pretty much where most people would go when it came to that, because that was the convenient option.
But because the government didn't work with Canadians and step up to the plate of providing the solution, it has been instead filled by the banking sector. Oh, banking sector, it's been a while. Instead of allowing you to sign into your bank with your government login, you instead can...
Sorry, I never want to sign into my bank with a government login. I want something separate. I want them to change their authentication methods. Because, yeah, signing into a web bank with your PIN or with, you know, a SMS code, those are not sufficient. I would like to see banks up their own game. But no, I don't want those two things to be linked fundamentally ever.
No, and we live in a country where the government very recently has been seizing bank accounts
right.
from people. And you know what? They can do that whether or not they have direct access to your account just by, you know, a flick of the wand, the legal wand. But they do now have a direct line into your bank account. They like the idea that you filing your taxes and then going, yeah, I authorize you to take this much out of my account. and that that's the max they can ever take. And that if for some reason it was decided that they needed to take all your money, you know, maybe they've decided you misfiled your taxes in 2012. And now because you've been found guilty or, you know, until proven otherwise, you've misfiled your taxes. Well, they're going to seize all your money. And sure, you can appeal it. You've got, recourse. It'll just take 10 years to process. So many problems.
Right. And I think especially in Canada, the close relationship our banks have with our government is its own problem. The idea that we should enhance this further is honestly downright scary, because I would like to see more banking independence if we want to continue having banks at all, which is a whole other discussion.
Yeah, and I do just want to point out, I think, at least in some aspects, we're agreeing with the video right now. Like, I think the video is... Oh, wow, I got a thumbs up emoji beside my head. Talk about dystopia. Anyway, I think that he clearly doesn't have too fond a relationship with the banks. That's all I'm saying.
And sign into your government with your bank login. They've created a for-profit organization called SecureKey and VerifiedMe, which look on the surface like RealMe, but that's much less useful, not accountable at all to citizens, and has a total agenda. Our government is stuck in our...
Maybe he should share what that agenda was. It's a shame he doesn't elaborate on verified.me or the other institution's agenda that he points out. Because I would venture a guess that what he's alluding to is the fact that governments and corporations are wrestling for control over human beings. And he has just simply chosen a side that he would rather government win that fight, which may be a defensible position. I don't want my Amazon ID to rule me over, period. But I believe it is worth discussing the fact that we can choose neither. We absolutely are at the point where it is not so far along that it is inevitable we choose one of those two paths. And so it's interesting that he's being soft on governments and harsh on corporations, when fundamentally in every country in the world, corporations only get the leeway they do because of governments. So it's really interesting to see this government good, corporations bad, but not actually addressing the root problem of, hey, maybe these privacy invasions have more to do with the root fundamentals of what we're doing rather than just who's doing it.
A half-outsourced state for its single sign-on government authentication system. Canada is the country where the government still operates liquor stores but has outsourced checking your identification. But there is hope. I went province by province and looked at the login services for the various provincial governments and how you do a range of things. Pay taxes, fines, driver's license, health records, municipal logins. So for the small provinces, they suck. Many of them have just dead links and 404s. Half of websites look they were designed by someone's uncle.
If you look at that map, you'll notice he picked a few provinces and a few. Well, no, they're all provinces. He didn't look at the territories. So these are not all of Canada's systems. No matter what the reasoning was and how he, you know, decided which ones would be included and excluded, this is not a complete record of what he's talking about. And I know that as a matter of fact, because Saskatchewan's not on there, and Saskatchewan, eHealth Saskatchewan, is indeed hooked in with the smart health card system. And so I just want to point out, just that's just one example of something that is strangely omitted from this.
Yeah, at the risk of stretching this out a bit, could you elaborate on why specifically you're concerned about the smart health card system? Because we've brought it up a couple of times, and I'm just wondering what you think is worth really sharing about what it is and why it can be problematic.
Well, it is the private sector of companies around the world that have adopted this system. It's a protocol. Anyone could have come up with something and then everyone else agreed on it. Basically out of, I believe it's Boston Children's Hospital, this particular, you know, standard was developed, and this particular tech that then coalesced, brought together a number of separate private sector and NGO sponsored digital ID and immunity passport platforms, you know, that were being developed separately around the world and like overnight connected them all together and established a global private sector vaccine passport system, which was so thinly veiled as strictly a vaccine passport. That was never what it was designed for. This is a digital ID platform designed to integrate the entire world. But then, for some reason, governments around the world at every level, from municipal to international, you know, the World Health Organization, the United Nations, everybody adopted this standard. And even the ones that didn't do it directly, you know, like, for example, the EU health pass. I don't think it was specifically like signed on to the smart health card infrastructure, but it's definitely been made to be compatible with it. Mm. So you've got layers of, you know, interconnectedness. The point is, like, smart health card wound up being on the verification side controlled by, and it sounds ridiculous to say, the World Economic Forum. You've got the verification side of it that is literally a project of the World Economic Forum through the open, common health or common.
Common pass?
Common pass was their product that was then swapped over into the smart health card. Oh, common. Hold on. I'm going to pull it up specifically. Oh, I think the Commons Network, and then they started the Common Trust the Commons Project, which started the Common Trust Network. And, you know, I think it's meant to be confusing, you know, they got Common Health, the Common Pass, Commons Project. Anyway, the main point is, so you've got like the global gathering of the private sector in the World Economic Forum. And then for some reason, all the governments around the world decided this was the one they were going to adopt. Specifically, the government of Canada. I don't know what led to this, but they adopted as the mandatory national framework the smart health card system. And so the provinces had developed their own separate one, some of them at least, but they were then required by law to synchronize their systems with the smart health card framework so as to be compatible with ArriveCan, which was the app that was, as everyone knows now, developed on what was supposed to be like an $80,000 budget, and it became $54 million. So these are not things that have escaped controversy, but people have not put together that the smart health card infrastructure in Canada was funded by, like, out of the ArriveCan budget. Anyway, there's all sorts of reasons to find this avoidable. Again, these were not built just to store a vaccine credential, let alone just one for COVID. These are designed to integrate around the entire planet. And so that's why when I hear about like Verify Me or Real Me, I think it's called New Zealand, the first thing I do is I look to see if it is, you know, part of this system. And it's not as if there's always a list and, oh, you can go hunt down, is Real Me on this list? And if it is, then the answer is yes. And I'm no tech whiz, but the way in which these systems have been developed separately and then are brought together to overlap, and this is over the course of decades, it's alarming, because we haven't, as a culture, talked about it as in terms of whether this is a good idea. And most people are so far behind in terms of knowing what has happened and what is being talked about as the desired infrastructure at the end of this path. So that's what smart health cards are. And there's probably a link we can give people to a piece that I wrote on this if they want to know more.
Sounds great. And the reason why I wanted to devote a bit of time to talking about smart health cards is because what interested me in that particular platform is it included an attestation fragment, which meant if you were using your smart health card at a entryway, somebody had to sign off on your access. This was specifically a permission gated system. And to me, that was what put out alarm bells in my mind. And I had been looking at many of the various different single sign-on technologies. So for instance, many institutions are trying to switch away from passwords to pass keys and various different authentication technologies. I was looking at FIDO too, which actually has a lot of really great aspects to it. I think without attestation, it is literally all we need. I actually think if I was given a FIDO key by the Government of Canada to sign in to just Government of Canada websites, I hate to say it, I would actually go for that, because that's probably more secure than whatever they're building, and honestly more reliable. And that's really the rub, fundamentally, is that I think attestation is the way these systems use to justify some of the more nefarious aspects of gating and control, and even fundamentally surveillance. Why does every visit to the store or whatever need to be checked in at any other place? And that's really what's scary about these digital ID systems. It's not the diminutive form they exist now, but how they can be potentially applied once they are allowed to kind of grow in, out of control.
And just to answer, because I think there is an answer to that question someone would give. Mm-hmm. Why does every visit to the grocery store need to be monitored? Well, because you might be a vector of disease, Gabriel.
You or some other social concern.
Or some other social concern. And so the point is, if people kind of revisit, if you haven't in a while, the premise of you potentially being a vector for disease such that you need to be checked in at every single entryway to every single place you go, like the grocery store, it may be time to revisit whether that was ever true.
Exactly.
Some tables, TD, row span. As you click around, you bounce from one decrepit dated design to another in this Frankenstein's mixing bowl of stitched together government services. It's not a surprise that they don't have a vision to set up a login system. They can't even follow a design guide.
Worst case, Ontario, you get caught, you just cancel the check.
Ontario has one key, and you can log in to pay tax, register a business, and that's it. No healthcare records, no federal integration, still using a security question. I was surprised how crap their system was for the largest province in Canada. Get it together, Ontario. Jesus Christ. In the middle are two provinces, starting with BC. In BC, there's a thing called the BC Services Card app. It has very few things attached to it. So say you want to register a business, you have to ironically use One Stop, or you can log in with your BC eID, which can be used for that and a lot of less common services like adopting a kid. The fact that you have to pay for your license.
I can speak to this because I've just recently incorporated a business, White Rose Intelligence. And the one thing he got wrong there is so I went through the One Stop system. Great. And then at the end of it, in order to do some extra step at the end, which was necessary, I still had to register for a BC EID. So you still are being put into two separate ID systems that should all just be one stop, as he's saying. So again, this is a real problem that doesn't, like, there's no reason it should exist the way it does currently.
It's renewal in BC at an office. And then the road test is this form where you get given a code word that is sometimes your mother's maiden name, for example, is a real disservice for what's probably Canada's most technologically advanced province. BC's problem is that it's just all over the show with these multiple sign-on systems. If they unified behind just one thing, they'd probably be in first place, but instead you've got I don't know what's going on. Get it together, BC. Quebec has a slightly different problem. There is a login system that's been around since 2005. It has address verification. It has logins for tax. It even lets you get your health records, but that is where things fall apart. It has a different problem to BC. It's not that it has too many competing logins. It's a problem of having stalled out under the existing login system. The system is dated and stuck in a paradigm that's very 2000s. But on the good side, Quebec is in the process of modernizing it with the new Quebec Digital ID and the new Department of Crypto Security and Digital. Yes, it's just called Crypto Security and Digital.
Well,
and it makes you go like...
That's not strictly the direct translation of that. I think cybersécurité translates to cybersecurity, but I digress.
Crypto Security and Digital... No, that's it. Okay, great. So I'm feeling a little bit more optimistic about Quebec. Let's go, Quebec. But there is one province that is already doing things right. Scoring twice the number of points in my spreadsheet ranking is Alberta's My Alberta.
My Alberta Digital ID, or MADI for short, is a digital tool that we use in Alberta for Albertans to authenticate who they are and to log in safely and securely, and then use that as a single portal to interact with a growing list of e-services, giving them more choice and more convenience.
Following Ray is on.
It lets you verify, log into tech stuff, register a business, get health records, sign up for student services.
Right on.
And even in some cases, that might be with Canada-wide services. Albertans can actually link.
All right, can
with
I just pause this here real quick?
Yeah.
So this was the last one that I had time to do a bit of pre-digging on, and I couldn't find anything. And I thought that was strange. I did find an article, though, from April 2022. So would that have been before or after this video was published?
Yes, it would have been after. It was published in February.
Okay, so this is the headline from mobileidworld.com. Alberta searches for digital ID director even as Premier denies program's existence.
Damn.
And I thought that was very funny. While the service Alberta, so they're trying to hire somebody. So while they've confirmed that the listing is legitimate, Alberta Premier Jason Kenney is somewhat bizarrely denying that Alberta has any kind of digital ID program. He described Alberta's digital ID plans as an urban legend in a recent Q&A with his constituents and claimed not to have any knowledge about the digital ID programs that are already in place because this one was introduced in 2015. And then they talk about Derek Sloan and they make it a crazy conspiracy theorist thing. But I thought that was hilarious, especially because they appear to have changed the name of the program to something a little less on the nose.
Always got to change it. Actually, it's real. I'm really glad he included this interview with the representative because there's a moment I'm going to highlight later because it's really on the money.
System to authenticate and then access things like the Canada Pension Plan, employment insurance, old age security, etc.
I was so happy to see a province in Canada showing us how to do it.
Yeah, well, this has been in the works for a very, very long time. It was first implemented in 2015. You know, I guess we would be the third government to be working on this.
It's amazing how much mileage you can get out of just executing a reasonably solid plan. One of the things that Alberta has done right is the login being an independent thing set up by the Ministry of Service.
As the Minister of Service Alberta, who's responsible for the digital backbone of government and responsible for the MADI tool, I'm really excited to look for every opportunity to expand the list of services that Albertans can access through this tool.
The game plan, if you're a government in Canada, is to set up the structure and give the bureaucrats a long-term strategy that self-corrects as technology changes.
As long as you're focused on continuous improvement.
Secondly, spin the system into a separate entity whose job is to make a useful service that anyone can use. If it's useful, let institutions in your society use it.
A big
Sorry, just quickly, when it talks about spinning it into a different entity, as somebody who's worked in an entity that wasn't strictly under government, there are concerns with accountability when you are trying to interact with an organ that is technically, you know, working on behalf of the government, but isn't the government. Suddenly, a lot of the protections people take for granted as Canadians when it comes to human rights and other aspects of really citizen participation, those kind of go out the window when you're dealing with an entity that technically is at an arm's length. So I think separating it out, you know, it can be a department, by all means, have a organization that's focused, you know, that's one thing. But when you are explicitly advocating for something kept at an arm's length, that's concerning to me.
Focus for me is to try and get to the point where every Albertan wants to have a MADI account because the value it offers to them is so great that they can't say no.
Can't say no. I won't risk rewinding it, but fundamentally that was what I was waiting for him to say. And he cuts it so quickly after that, but it's such an important point. I feel like his entire video is kind of derailed by this simple fact that he interviewed a bureaucrat who literally says, we want to integrate it so deeply into everybody's lives that they cannot say no.
You know, it seems to me you might imagine he thought it sounded like, oh, they love it so much they can't say. That's sort of the flair he gave it, but that's not what he said. And that's not what he's describing.
Well, especially when as he points out, oh, it should be used with all these different institutions. And I'm going to double down on what I said at the start, which is when you have one login to rule your entire life, that becomes such a valuable target. That becomes way more important than how you handle regular security. And what's hilarious is people are notoriously bad with regular account security, whether they care about digital ID or whether they love it. And so when you are raising the really responsibility of stewarding such a system, that is a big ask. And I think many of the people who are going to be opting into this for convenience are going to underestimate how inconvenient it is when they realize that the system doesn't exist for their convenience. It exists to protect the governments and institutions from their risk. And that's really what I think these systems are all about. I don't even necessarily think it is about surveillance. I think it's about if they want to offload cybersecurity risks onto individuals. So when there's a data breach or some other problem, they can say, oh, that's on you. That was your government digital ID. And guess what? Then everyone's up shit's creek.
Well, about this, obviously your eyes glaze over. Oh, what are you annoyed about this week, Paige? Painting bricks, is it? Oh no, government logins. Okay. But it's just a matter of time before that complacency bites them in the ass. I see it all the time. Maybe you're trying to book a vaccination appointment.
But you're entering the same details in 7 times. Look at the stupid fucking form. Keeps clearing.
Maybe you're experiencing some chest pains, but you're worried about going to...
Okay, 2 things back to back here. First, the complaint about the booking a vaccination appointment and having to enter the same information multiple times is exactly the basis of the complaints in that article I read earlier. Exactly the basis of the complaints about RealMe, the exact system he's been holding up as the gold standard this entire thing. So that's kind of funny. And maybe they fixed it in the year between that article, or the 6 months between the article and that video. 4 months. But the other thing is, there's just sometimes you'll watch something and you know, like, you're watching, somebody's got either a perspective you know you're going to disagree with. Sometimes you suspect it might be just straight up propaganda. Sometimes you just pick up on things. And I can't say this is on purpose. I'm just saying the putting the booking the vaccination appointment and the maybe you're having heart pain back to back, intentional or otherwise, that's a very dark thing to have said.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions, and many people speculate as to whether the mainstream will put certain messages to mock people who know what's going on, and this hits dangerously close to that mark.
And, you know, again, so it doesn't even need to be that. The problem is that it seems that way, and,
yeah,
like, that can't just be ignored. Like, we have to talk about that. Like, and I mean, like, the person who made this video and the people like us who are like, who hear something probably different than what he intended to say. It probably was a case of him being tone deaf to that particular issue, which is the connection between those 2 things that he just said. He probably didn't think of them as being connected, because why would he? Why would, well, I was going to say, why would most people, but I'm not going to say that. So yeah, either way, it's bad.
Yeah.
Hospital because you lost your healthcare card. Maybe your passport got stolen while you're traveling, and so you're stuck there trying to figure out a Russian word for fax machine, thinking, God, can we not do this better? The worst thing is, a lot of the time, citizens do absolutely everything right, and the problem still comes back to them. In 2017, over 160 million citizens of the US, Canada, and the UK had their data stolen during the Equifax breach. If you're watching this video and English is your first language, there's a 1 in 3 chance that your personal information is...
So somebody on this screen, for example.
But he said that as if it's everyone else's fault than Equifax. The way he said that was, even if you do everything right, you know, good people can still have bad things happen. That sounds, yeah, like people at Equifax need to go to jail.
Yeah,
it doesn't immediately flow then that the A to Z there is insane.
Agreed. I mean, I think what they're trying to communicate is the private sector can't handle this. And the problem is if that's true, many of us would have even less faith that the public sector could, which is where my personal priority when it comes to this stuff, is I think we need to distribute risk, not consolidate it. And it seems like he's saying, how can we fix consolidating risk? And my response is, you can't. Like, that's fundamentally the issue.
And Equifax, by the way, is it doesn't get much bigger and more ubiquitous than Equifax. They're our credit reporting agency. They're tied in, they're one in the same with the banks, probably literally, if we look at who actually owns it. And we just finished talking about how, whether it's this way or that way, the banks and the government are now intimately connected. So especially, the lines here are so much blurrier than he's letting on.
Some
hackers hard drive.
Sorry, it's worth pointing out that a digital ID would not solve this particular problem, because no matter what authentication mechanism you use, a data breach is a data breach. If somebody has access to the database, it is a much harder job to make sure that's protected, and it's a completely separate issue. Don't get me wrong, it helps, absolutely, but it's not the thing that solves the problem.
That data has never surfaced for sale. It's a ticking time bomb that could be unleashed at any time to get passports, credit cards, and to undermine our society's dated methods of verifying that we are who we say we are.
How convenient. Oh, this horrible thing has happened. The extent of the damage we haven't figured out yet. And how convenient that this has given us the opportunity to now roll out this thing that we want to roll out for reasons other than the main premise. I'm just saying that's pretty convenient.
Years to prepare, years to repeal and replace the old way of doing things, but our governments don't do anything about it because we don't hassle them about it. As Alberta shows, Canadian governments have the ability to make good long-term plans and execute them on this issue. Many of them just haven't for various reasons. I suspect that Alberta being in first place is no coincidence. Their citizens are well known for being fiscal conservatives that are hard on their government, skeptical, and make governments sweat. If you want a better government, you have to be critical of the government. You have to harass them and make their lives hard. So I'm going to do my part and yell into that fucking void. Doing digital government badly is now just doing government badly. It's not 2005 anymore. Signatures, printers, fax machines, mailing documents are all obvious signs of a failing government.
That's kind of a bold statement right there. Any analog system of interacting with your government is a sign that your government is failing. Now, don't get me wrong. I understand this security concerns of somebody's like, oh, I don't want my documents in the mail. However, I think this really just demonstrates an overconfidence in the digital solutions that exist fundamentally.
I wonder what this gentleman or this channel's perspective is on misinformation and what should be done about it.
I'd have to look, but I would not be surprised at all if they were in favor of very heavy-handed pushing on that.
If you have various digital strategies, that shit is dated or slow, or it's going in the totally wrong direction. The reason that I'm holding a New Zealand passport now isn't because they have a better website. It's because they now have a better government. Get it together.
So that may be true, but they fired a lot of people in the time leading up to him trying to get his passport. I returned to the point at the beginning. He is missing a huge part of this story. And if he then says, oh, well, that's fine because this will, you know, require less people to work at the government, that's a whole other can of worms.
I think this is an interesting example of the public side trying to push back against the corporate side. And I'm not particularly in favor of the corporate side of trying to consolidate many of these things. As you point out, the smart health card system really built the framework for it all to interconnect that was ready to go. And it's interesting how he pointed out that bureaucrats need to be given long form plans. And this is something that's near to my heart, because I believe those of us who actually do want to protect our rights in the face of digital governments, whatever that means, we do have to be proactive. We do have to not only think about these issues ourselves, but educate those around us, because far too many people, in my opinion, are solely interested in deciding how they can opt out of a system like this, while, I hate to say it, letting people like this convince everyone else, oh, it's perfectly fine for them. Look how incredible it is. Education, outreach, and being able to do a better job explaining what's wrong with this particular step or many other different policies that are going on, I think is the root to the real answer to how we protect our physical autonomy, but honestly, even digital rights as new and strange impositions get added in these times. And fundamentally, he is actually right that the answer is to get involved. He points out that being hard on your government, asking questions, being engaged is part of the process. Yes, I know a lot of people don't feel represented, but truthfully, the alternative is to cede power to even scarier organizations. And I think it is better to do what we can to make sure our governments are serving the function that they are supposed to without extreme overreaches. And I think a lot of that involves way more skepticism about what they're using data for, how widely it's shared between departments, figuring out what are the better ways of isolating information. Because truthfully, he made many references to it's not the 1950s anymore, it's not the 1980s anymore. And he's right. Time absolutely has passed. They've built these, you know, half exported digital ID systems, these half outsourced systems, and they are here and people are using them. And we need to figure out how we provide alternatives that respect people's privacy and security and fundamental right to have autonomy outside of the system as it exists. And that is, I think, where we actually need to regain ground rather than simply saying, oh, well, I'm not going to comply, so the problem's solved. I think it is a little more complicated than that. And that's why I wanted to have this conversation. And thank you so much for Liam for joining me. I had a great time doing this. I'm going to have to do a bit of editing and post to make sure the video displays nicely. But do you have anything else to share on our way out?
No, just that, you know, I agree with everything you said, and I especially agree with his final message, which is you have to engage your government. You have to make them uncomfortable. That is their job. They represent constituents that don't 100% agree on every topic. And so then if you have a system or an environment, an ecosystem where you can have debates and where you can have competing ideas battle it out, both between each other and into one ear of the government and, you know, into the other ear of the government and then in, you know, the houses of parliament themselves, then you will solve these problems for the most people in a way that is fair and that is actually legal and that doesn't require fundamentally rethinking what human rights are and changing laws to do things that were previously illegal. And so, you know, my concern is I hear so many people, like even like friends, family, who have this notion now, they use this word disinformation that I had never heard prior to the year 2020. I'm shocked at how ubiquitous this concept is now, which provides that there is only one good and one bad. And sure, there's variations, but they all still fall within one larger direction we're going. And so long as you remain within the boundaries, then we're all, you know, going to work just fine. No, it has to be that we can all be engaging, even with, you know, perspectives that are completely 180 degrees the opposite of the perspective being offered. And so I guess I'm a little cynical because, and this is my bias now, is I assume this gentleman is, because he, you know, said this, this, and this, he most likely would say I should not have a platform, for example, on social media or anywhere else to express what would be a opinion slightly different than his. So, yeah, go for it.
And what's ironic is I'll point out, I have no ill will towards the people working on this project. Ironically, I'm grateful they made this video so that we could have this opportunity to discuss this in greater detail. And this is what I think is the problem, is it's way too easy for people to get siloed from hearing the other side. And one of the things I found amazing about this is you get to see the arguments as they're actually being made, not necessarily than how some like rage bait on social media is going to present it. And I feel like that is what we need more in general. We need people coming together to discuss these issues in detail. We don't just need people to say, oh, I've got the way and it's the high road. We need to really deal with what we have before us. And I think people, even on the other side, doing their part in sharing the information as they see it is still useful to us. And this is, to me, a principal example of that, because I myself have been a little frustrated that when it comes to the digital ID discussion, there has been a lack of nuance. There has been a lack of seriousness when it comes to this and many other technological issues. And I found this was an excellent opportunity to highlight the concerns I've had in this space and other spaces. So thank you again, Liam, for joining me. And I'm very grateful for what you do with Right Rose Intelligence. I wish you all the greatest luck moving forward. And I wish you, the audience, excellent night.